This is Maggie Jones in Natural Wonders. I'm reading Wrong Tree, Adventures in Wildlife Biology by Jeff Wilson, illustrated by Terry Dalton, and published by the Cornerstone Press in Stevens Point. At the end of the reading of Wrong Tree, I will also read Margaret Renkel's recent article in the New York Times about whooping cranes 2 hours from her home at the Wheeler National Wildlife Refuge in Alabama. These two readings provide two sides of a very interesting coin, as you'll see. In a chapter titled Innocence Abroad, Jeff Wilson starts out with a quote from 2019. This is a message posted on Jeff and Terry's cabin door. "We are off searching for the meaning of life. We will be back when we find it or get hungry." The chapter is about their trip looking for the ivory-billed woodpecker when researchers thought that it had been found, but not confirmed by any means. And Jeff writes, "Terry and I were quite excited when, in 1999, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology made the announcement that the ivory-billed woodpecker had been rediscovered. Could this really be true? The ivory-billed had been declared extinct decades ago. It was an impressive, large woodpecker, sometimes referred to as the Lord God bird. The last bird, a lone female, had been observed in 1944. Because the announcement came from the Cornell Lab and the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, most biologists assumed there was firm evidence behind the claims. According to Cornell, the discovery site was the White River Wildlife Refuge in Arkansas. But it was a puzzle. Where had this extirpated species been hiding since the last sighting in 1944? Its picture had even been removed from some modern field guides, and its sad story was a well-known cautionary tale about the delicate relationship between people and animals. The species' last remaining population had been discovered back in 1935 by an ornithologist, also at Cornell Lab, named Arthur Allen. A student on the discovery team, James Tanner, took up the cause and did a research study of the birds documenting their decline to extinction. No bird had been seen since. The tragedy was that the birds could possibly have been saved had their habitat been protected. Tanner discovered that the species needed large tracts of river bottomland, forested with hardwoods that were large and included a mix of dead trees. That last dwindling population was living in Louisiana, in a large block of bottomland forest owned by the Singer Sewing Machine Company. Despite pleas from the scientific community to protect the habitat, Singer refused and logged off the tract in 1941. It was wartime, and the wood, they said, was needed to build cabinets for sewing machines used to sew uniforms and tents for the troops. Stephen Lynn Bale's book, The Grail Bird, The Rediscovery of the Ivory-billed Woodpecker, about Tanner and the demise of the ivory-billed, cites a bold quote from the chairman of the Chicago Mill and Lumber Company, who logged the Singer tract. "We are just money grabbers. We are not concerned, as you folks are, with the ethical considerations." Public attitudes have come a long way since then. Back in the 1930s, we had no Endangered Species Act, and never would have considered changing forest practices to save a species, as we've done recently for the spotted owl or Kirtland's warbler. It wasn't long after Cornell's announcement that Terry and I read an article in the magazine Florida Birder. The article stated that an ornithological team from Auburn University in Alabama had recently discovered another possible sighting of ivory-billed woodpeckers in the panhandle of Florida. Interesting, we thought. We traveled to Florida each winter to visit Terry's parents. Why not contact Auburn University and see if they could use some volunteers? We sent our resumes to Dr. Jeff Hill at Auburn and heard back from him right away. Yes, they could use our help. Dr. Hill noted my last 2 years at Wisconsin DNR as a forestry technician and asked if we could inventory forest plots throughout the bottomland hardwood to contribute to a habitat suitability index. This would help to better define the habitat requirements of the ivy billed should the sightings be confirmed. Dr. Hill had a graduate student and research team headquartered in a rented cabin near the study site in the Choctawhatchee River Basin. The forestry data would also be used to distinguish other areas where ivory-billed woodpeckers could be released if birds were located and captive rearing ever attempted. We knew absolutely nothing about southern bottomland hardwood forests. We didn't even know what tree species would be growing within our inventory plots. We had spent our entire careers in temperate and boreal forests in the Upper Great Lakes region. Don't worry, Dr. Hill said, my graduate student will train you. We told him we could give him 8 days, pack the car with anything we thought we might need, canoe, tent, camping gear, binoculars, spotting scope, chest waders, GPS unit, bird books, mosquito repellent, and proceeded south. The evidence supporting the rediscovery of this extinct bird was quite compelling. Several reputable ornithologists at both sites in Arkansas and Florida claimed to have seen the bird. There were also recordings thought to be the bird's Kent call and its double-knock drumming call, and measurements of possible nest holes. The data from Tanner's 1935 study in Louisiana had noted that ivory-billed nest cavities were wider and more elongated than those of their close cousin, the pileated woodpecker, which can also be found in similar habitat and has overlapping range. The earlier study also found that ivory bills often left sign of peeled bark they had pried away with their strong bills to reach beetle grubs, and the way they did the prying could be distinguished from that of pileated woodpeckers. The researchers felt they had found some evidence at both sites, but it was only circumstantial. No one had a clear photo or feather for DNA to prove beyond a doubt that the species still existed. It was also problematic that ivory-billed woodpeckers share many physical traits with the pileated. The species are of similar size, sport a red tuft on the head, and have a black tail and black feet. The ivory-billed was slightly larger, had a cream-colored bill, and a skunk-like white stripe down its back. If observed flying at much of a distance, even expert birders would have a hard time distinguishing between the two species. Terry and I thought, wow, what if we were the ones to get the perfect picture or find a feather or discover an active cavity roost? When we arrived in Ponce de Leon, Florida, a tiny town in the middle of nowhere, we met Brian Rolick, the graduate student we'd been looking for. Brian had been on that first expedition with Dr. Hill when they had initially observed what they believed was their ivory billed. There were two other team members at camp, a male undergraduate and a woman who was a contract biologist and had worked previously at the Cornell site in Arkansas. She had some great cottonmouth, water moccasin, snake stories to share. They had tried to crawl into her canoe numerous times, had crawled onto stumps next to her and gone to sleep, and she had even observed them copulating. The good news was that all these encounters occurred in warm weather, and at the moment, Florida's panhandle was pretty cool, making the venomous, cold-blooded snake sleepy. The next day, we received our training to conduct habitat site analysis. The bottomland hardwood forest in our study area was a mixture of tupelo, oak, spruce, cypress, sweet gum, and pine, with an understory of palmetto. It was common to have trees over 4 feet in diameter, and on the cypress trees, their knees, the cone-shaped structures on their roots, were up to 6 feet tall. Terry and I were in another world. We had a grid of GPS locations to visit and habitat plots to measure at each site. We were really going to experience the backwoods of Florida up close and personal. We headed out that afternoon up the Choctawhatchee River by canoe with food and supplies for 8 days. Our plan was to set up camp near the center of our plots so we wouldn't have to move camp very often. Brian had said, "Try to locate your camp on high ground because 2 inches of rain upstream in Alabama equates to a 2-foot river rise down here." We paddled several miles the first day, found a nice site, and set up camp. The next day we set to work, all the while marveling at the cathedral of huge trees braided with rivulets and creeks. The method was to canoe as close as possible to our plot centers, then tie the canoe and carefully slosh through the watery habitat to the exact GPS location. Care had to be taken as the water was dark and deep holes or tree roots were not visible. Water filling our chest waders would have made for a very uncomfortable day. We recorded the plot data in about 20 minutes and then moved on to the next, usually half a mile or more away. Tree species, tree density, height, diameter, ground cover, and presence and absence of snags and tree cavities were all noted using many of the same instruments I used in Wisconsin while conducting forestry reconnaissance. During our work, we saw beaver, deer, wild boar, and squirrels, and recorded pileated woodpeckers, hawks, owls, and numerous songbirds, but we saw no ivory bills. Then it started to rain. It was our third day, and it began in the late morning and continued all day and into the night. It was a hard rain, and who knew how much had fallen farther up the watershed. It was Terry who saved our camp. She has always bitterly complained that I can sleep through any tempest, leaving her stuck with the nocturnal checks for loosened tent stakes, drifting boat anchors, or bears sniffing out a midnight snack. She woke up in the middle of the night and decided to look outside the tent to check the river. She didn't have to look far because the river was about 2 inches away and rising. She called the alarm and we put on our headlamps and started packing. In 10 minutes, we had everything in the canoe and were paddling for higher ground. We reset camp and got a good night's sleep, but Brian's warning had been accurate. We completed our work on schedule and spent the last night back at the research cabin with the rest of the crew. They had been installing sound recording equipment to try to record the suspected ivory bill's Kent calls and double knock drum call. They had also been searching for tree cavities to measure for possible nest or resting sites. They also had their cameras ready in hopes of a possible photo, but there had been no sightings while we were there. Dr. Jeff Hill eventually wrote a book on the ivory-billed woodpecker titled Ivory Bill Hunters, The Search for Proof in a Flooded Wilderness. Brian Rolick completed his master's thesis, yet no definitive proof ever surfaced that the ivory-billed had truly been found. A year or so later, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology released a statement that their observation and a few seconds of video were not fully substantiated, and they abandoned the search for the elusive ivory-billed. Much was made of this admission, and monies expended on the fruitless search for the Lord God bird. Terry and I felt some empathy for the biologists who had worked on the search. We talked about how easy it would have been to wrongly identify a pileated when we were in that bottomland forest. We saw quite a few, and each time our adrenaline rose while we scoped the birds for telltale markings. The hard part was that they were usually on the wing and disappearing before we got our feet on stable ground and could raise and focus the binoculars for a clear look. It was a magical forest with its giant trees, knobby cypress roots, and the continual rustle of the palmetto fronds. It was also slightly eerie when rising waters erased all landforms, creating a maze that could only be navigated by GPS. I can still feel the quick surge of excitement we felt when we saw the dipping flight of a pileated in that Choctawhatchee bottomland. We were saddened that the ivory bill was again declared extinct, but after our adventure, we came away with much deeper appreciation of what that king of woodpeckers must have been like. And that's the end of their ivory-billed woodpecker trip. I also wanted to read a recent opinion piece in the New York Times by Margaret Renkel, R-E-N-K-L. Her article is titled, "The Whooping Crane Recovery Shows What We Stand to Lose." This is March 2nd, 2026. And it says here, Ms. Renkel, a contributing opinion writer, reports from Nashville on flora, fauna, politics, and culture in the American South. And Margaret writes, "I probably wouldn't have made the drive to Wheeler National Wildlife Refuge in North Alabama back in January if I hadn't gotten an email bearing this subject line, Whooping Cranes." The message came from Nicole Mashburn, a board member of the Wheeler Wildlife Refuge Association and the friend of a friend. "Out of abject necessity, I ignore 90% of the emails I get, even emails from friends of friends, but put whooping cranes in the subject line and you have me. Hook, line, sinker, and fishing net. I thought you might like to know we have 18 whooping cranes this year," Miss Mashburn wrote. "I don't keep a life list of birds I've seen or go to any length to see rare birds, but the whooping crane is more than simply rare and more than simply beautiful. It's a rare and beautiful bird that still exists because human beings decided a long time ago that it should exist. Wheeler is a sprawling 35,000-acre sanctuary along the Tennessee River, and its wetland habitats offer ideal wintering grounds for migratory waterfowl of many types. It's always worth the drive to Wheeler in winter because of the magnificent sandhill cranes that overwinter there every year, gathering by the tens of thousands. They talk to one another continuously in a joyous, burbling call that always makes me think an odd sort of marching band is tuning up with instruments I don't recognize. But I've already seen the glorious flock of sandhills at Wheeler, and I was in the midst of an uncommonly busy winter, so I probably wouldn't have made the trip again this year if not for Ms. Mashburn's email about the whooping cranes. Those majestic white birds are the tallest in America, each standing 5 feet tall, with a wingspan of nearly 7 feet, and we almost lost them forever. Never known to exist in large numbers, the whooping cranes were nonetheless geographically widespread in North America until farming and hunting pushed them to the brink of extinction. By 1941, the worldwide population of whooping cranes numbered barely more than 20. But nearly that many were stalking around in the flooded fields of the Wheeler Wildlife Refuge in January, less than 2 hours from my house. My husband and I made plans to head down and see if we could find them. Even after decades of intense effort to help the species rebound through a combination of habitat conservation and an innovative breed and release program, the total population of whooping cranes today is only around 800. So if you're a whooping crane and you need a flock for safety, you throw in your lot with the much more numerous sandhills. Thomas V. Ress, a Wheeler board member, longtime volunteer, and the author of Wheeler National Wildlife Refuge, told us how to figure out which local predators are targeting the flock. "If all of a sudden you see the ducks rise up, there's a good chance there's an eagle nearby. If you see all the sandhills rise up, there's a good chance there's a coyote going through the field." But coyotes aren't the whooping crane's greatest danger, or the sandhills either. The Trump administration's unceasing assault on environmental protections threatens to undo decades of conservation efforts on behalf of whooping cranes and every other threatened or endangered species. I wondered if this might be my only real chance to see a whooping crane in the wild. The thing about trying to find a whooping crane tucked among a vast flock of sandhills in a vast wildlife refuge is that sandhills are also giant birds, and in certain light, as for example the light reflected from water on a sunny day, It is not easy to tell whether a bird is a pale gray sandhill or whether it is a white whooping crane. My husband and I stood behind one of the several bird blinds at Wheeler and debated, is that one a whooper? Is that one? Then someone pointed to the far right of the viewing area, and there they were, two whooping cranes walking calmly among the sandhills. As it turns out, when you see a whooping crane, you cannot doubt you are seeing one. No other living thing like it exists in all the world. It's like seeing something from myth. It's like stepping backward onto an earth as yet untouched by human hands. In that instant, I learned that I didn't need to see Wheeler's whooping cranes out of fear that I'd otherwise miss my chance. I needed to see them to remember what my own species is capable of. To see a whooping crane in the wild is to be reminded that we nearly killed something miraculous, and then, almost unbelievably, we didn't. Against all evidence to the contrary, we are as much the healing species as the murdering one. The question is whether we still have the wisdom to save what we have the ability to save. Back when a bipartisan effort by Congress saved the bald eagle and the peregrine falcon, when it protected our water and our air and set up a mechanism for protecting our most vulnerable species, we did. I would not have believed it possible even then, with the country in nearly the same turmoil the country is in now. But we did. It was President Richard Nixon who signed into law the Clean Air Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and the Endangered Species Act. President Nixon who established the Environmental Protection Agency. He did these things because voters, newly awake to what they were on the precipice of losing forever, insisted on saving what could yet be saved. Surely there is room now, too, even amid so many other fights to protect what we love, to protect the living world that sustains our wild neighbors, the living world that sustains us, too. For us, it's personal. If we lose our wetlands, we will have lost our best chance for absorbing storm surges in a time of extreme weather patterns. If our water is unsafe for amphibians, it is unsafe for us, too. When the air we breathe is full of toxins, wild creatures are not the only ones to suffer. At a species level, it is nothing less than suicidal to believe that human beings are exempt from the ravages that human beings keep subjecting the earth to. But the living world also sustains us in ways we hardly recognize until we have been deprived of it for too long. The feel of turned soil in our hands, the scent of flowers on a breeze, the sound of birdsong pouring down from the trees. This is the world we evolved in, the world we were born for. Lately, my brother and I have been visiting schools and bookstores to read from our new picture book about the many lives a wildflower garden sustains. Small hands always shoot up when we ask if there are any questions, but rarely do the children ask questions. They prefer instead to tell us about the creatures they love. I like squirrels, one preschooler said when we called on her. I like butterflies, another said when it was his turn. These little ones were already all in. I like worms. I like birds. I like ladybugs. I like bunnies. They reminded me of a child I met at Wheeler National Wildlife Refuge late in the day when we went to see the cranes. Peering through a cutout in one of the bird blinds, the toddler leaned forward to see the birds as they were just beginning to lift off at sunset. Wow, he whispered amid the rush of wings. Oh, wow. And that's the wonderful Margaret Renkel's most recent writing in the New York Times, March 2nd, 2026. What a contrast to the ivory-billed woodpecker, which we chose not to save. A couple of thoughts. Margaret Renkel's new book is called The Weedy Garden, A Happy Habitat for Our Wild Friends, illustrated by her brother Billy, and it's available in many places. Don't forget the people who have worked the hardest to save cranes in the world and work with people all over the world are the people at the International Crane Foundation. Their website is savingcranes.org. They open to the public with a beautiful, beautiful campus with all the cranes of the world that you can see and photograph in beautiful natural surroundings. And they have a beautiful prairie, too, you can walk through. The International Crane Foundation is near Baraboo, and they open every season around May 1st. So be sure and check Saving Cranes for the details on where they are, what they do, and when they open. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you so much for listening.